Welcome to the Artist Mother Podcast, featuring interviews with incredible working artists who are also mothers and compelling conversations regarding parenting and the art world. These conversations create a space for inclusivity and support for artist mothers worldwide. I'm Kaylin Butine, painter, mom of three, and podcast host. I'm so grateful you are tuning in, and I hope you enjoy this episode.
What do I really like about doing this? It's like, it's just sitting there looking at fabric and like counting, literally counting stitches on that embroidery of a flower and trying to emulate it with paint. And I don't know if that's like a worthy cause, but like that gave me great joy for the next 3 hours, right? So I wanted to do that and I just kept doing that. And this is the new body of work that grew out of that, kind of like shutting out the world and the expectations of, you know, being that Korean artist or having that Korean narrative and going like, nope, just gonna be like the best painter I can be. And specifically best fabric, like let's get really, really, really nitty gritty to what I wanna do. And they're like, just be really good at one thing, you know? And that's something to be, you know, that's a great motivation. Just try to get really, and then every day I go into the studio, I'm like, I don't know if I didn't hit it last time with that fabric, I'm gonna do it again and try to make it better. Try to make it as good as I can make it and be proud of that.
I am thrilled to welcome Leah Ju to the Artist Mother Podcast today. Leah is a Korean-American painter based in Connecticut. Born in 1971 in Seoul, Leah was raised by a sculptor father and an illustrator mother. At age 10, her family moved to Indianapolis, where she spent her youth. She studied painting and art history at Indiana University in Bloomington and received her MFA in painting from the Yale School of Art. Her paintings have been exhibited widely in the U.S. and South Korea and recognized with awards from Pollock Krasner, George Sugarman Foundation, and the Connecticut Commission for the Arts. And since 1996, she has taught and served as visiting artist at many institutions, including the Kansas City Art Institute, Maryland Institute College of Art, Hartford Art School, and Fairfield University. Leah currently lives and paints in Middlebury, Connecticut, and teaches at Southern Connecticut State University and Pear College. Leah, I love your work. Thank you so much for agreeing to be on the podcast and telling us a bit of your story.
Thank you so much for having me. It's a real honor.
Of course. Okay, so I love that your bio already had a little bit of that background, but why don't you tell us a bit more about how you found your way as an artist? It sounds like you were raised in a home where art was very much a part of just your everyday life, but did you anticipate growing up and being an artist? Was that always something you thought you would do?
Yeah, with my parents both having art backgrounds, I've always, you know, I've drawn, you know, I'm that kid who like drew all over the walls as a toddler.
Hopefully in pencil, not marker.
Like whatever was available. And, but it's funny, I think because it's my parents knew, you know, having a art career and sustaining it is very challenging. So when I got really serious about it, you know, in college, and I said, I'm gonna major in painting. And they kind of went, no. How about you do graphic design where you can get a job or something more useful?
Yeah.
So they were, I think they knew that my passion was there, but they were really, you know, they were just worried like any parents, just, mm-hmm. you know, hoping the best for the kids. And I, you know, but then I was kind of stubborn and I said, no, I'm going to do it. And my parents, although their background is in art, their careers, with the careers in Korea, my dad, he was a set designer, although he was trained as a sculptor, but, you know, his day job was a set designer, which is very much because of his art background, he was able to pursue that. And my mom did some animation, like this is like in the 60s and 70s, so like,
yeah,
you know, like animation in a big production company where she would just do like coloring for the background, that kind of thing. So wow. Very in, you know, like sort of industry commercial art. So, you know, it wasn't like they were showing at galleries and right. It wasn't that sort of a upbringing that I had. So they were concerned, but it took a long time for them to realize that you can actually, you know, make a living doing it. I think even when I got into grad school, they were still kind of concerned. They're like, oh, more school?
This yeah. More debt, more this.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. I think for them, they felt a little bit relieved when I first got a full-time teaching job a couple years after grad school. And they thought, okay, she can pay for all student loans. Like, okay, now we're okay. And they were pretty much your typical parents, although they have great understanding and, you know, talent and knowledge about art world.
When they moved, so when you said that you moved at age 10 to Indy, was that from Korea?
Yes, it was.
So what, I'm just curious, like, what was that experience like of your parents kind of having these careers in Korea? And then, you know, did they move for a job? Did they move specifically? And maybe you want to talk a little bit about that time in your life being 10 and moving to Indy.
Yeah. Right? Yeah. They wanted to move. They definitely wanted to immigrate to US because they had some siblings living here and they just thought it would be a really great future for us, me and my brother specifically. And my dad had a little bit of a connection with Walt Disney in California. He had a former school friend who was working there. It wasn't like a job that was waiting for him, but, you know, he just had this friend who happened to be doing graphic design with Disney. So we first landed in California, like back, this is 1982. Mm-hmm. And I was like 10 and a half. And we thought, you know, he tried, like he went on interviews and he tried, but, you know, his English was, it became over, I guess it was enough of a concern. Like he wasn't able to get those jobs. So he wasn't able to communicate well enough. So we stayed there for about a month in California. I think my life would have been really different if I was raised in California, like growing up in, you know, LA, Koreatown, maybe joined the Korean gang or something. But LA was a little bit challenging for them to kind of land on their feet and sort of figure out what to do. So my aunt, we had two aunts, my mom's two sisters had been living in Indianapolis for a long time. So they said, you know, it's a quiet place. It's clean. It's cheap. Come try out here. So we moved there and, you know, that's one of those kind of going back to their, worries about art careers is that they realize that they can't really, you know, just kind of come up with an art career out of nowhere as fresh immigrants. So they opened up a Korean restaurant, with no like business background whatsoever. But it's something you can kind of do. That's the remarkable thing about this country. You can do that. You can open up something and then work really hard and, you know, pay your rent and move on. So
your parents sound really scrappy and like they have a lot of innovation and entrepreneurial, you know, guts, I guess. Like they're
absolutely. Yeah. Like it's something I could never do. I'm like, I'm a real planner. Like if I don't know what my plan B is
and what your salary is going to be. And
I won't even venture that way, but, it's amazing. Yeah. They were you know, in their mid 40s at that time. So it's kind of incredible what they did, looking back. I started fifth grade kind of over again, just to kind of get caught up with the language.
Right.
In a suburb of Indianapolis, went through middle school, high school there.
Okay.
And then I stayed there for undergrad. So yeah, then I became a Hoosier.
Yeah. And
as you know all about.
I guess I'm now a Hoosier. We've only lived in Indiana for 3 years. And of course, you know, I'm in Fort Wayne, which is 2 hours north of Indy. But there's, you know, the Midwest is not a place I ever thought I would like want to live. But we kind of love it here.
Yeah.
There's an ease about life here. And there's so much focus on family life here.
Yes.
that I think there's just a lot of things that set you up, especially for the phase of life that John and I are in when we're kind of, we have young kids, you know, so. So I'm curious, like, as a Korean American 10-year-old who's kind of thrown in the Midwest in this preteen like age, was art something that was really like, was that a connection point for you? Did it become, you know, something that you relied on to help you process what I'm sure was, you know, a scary and maybe exciting, like just a mixed bag of emotions, like a very
absolutely. And you know, early 80s, especially Indiana, Korean culture is just not in daily, you know, vocabulary. Like there's no K-pop and there's no K-drama. Kids didn't even know where Korea was located, you know, back then. So I didn't speak any English at all, like when we moved here. So I do remember kids were kind mostly, and I can't talk to them. I mean, you pick it up pretty quickly as a kid, but I remember like one thing I can do is draw. You know, I drew very well. And I would draw and I would draw them. I would like draw a picture of like Marilyn Monroe or like Michael Jackson and like pass it over to a girl next to me and they'll be like, what? And it was a way to communicate without words. So for me, I became that, you know, that artsy kid. And I think that really defined me as a teenager. You know, I really kind of embraced that and ran with it, you know, and try to, you know, run the art department a little bit, a little bit of a, you know, stake, you know, in that large property of high school, which was really, really tough. But, you know, at least I can have my little group, my community in the art department, which was great.
Okay, so that, I love that, how art became this connection point and also a way for you to kind of process American culture, like at the time, you know, through like visuals. And it's just so interesting because now I'm like, well, kids just look at that stuff on Instagram or they have access to so much more information. And it's like, no, you had a pad and paper and you could like probably, you know, some teen bop magazines and like whatever kind of, so just that, I don't know. It's just interesting to think about how the time and space that you were in, you know, like a kid going through the same experience now would process that probably differently, but hopefully there would be some similarities there. Before we get into talking about your work, because I have a question related to your work connected to that, I would love for you to just tell us a little bit more about who you are today. I love your Instagram bio description. Can I read it? It says, painter, mother, teacher in Connecticut. If I were a book, it would be called, quote, Woman in the Shed, a dark comedy thriller about a painter and her backyard studio mishaps. I think that's so funny and sweet and brilliant. Can you tell me a little bit more about that and kind of just your everyday life?
Sure. I should call it the studio. I mean, my shed is where I make my work. And I have for a long time here at this house. Well, first of all, I teach at two colleges part-time. So I'm usually out of the house for 3 days out of the week, most of the day, because the way Connecticut's laid out, it's like an hour commute to each job, although you're only there for a few hours to teach that, you know, studio class. Rest of the time, I'm painting and I'm parenting kids. I have a 16-year-old and an 18-year-old freshman in college. So a little bit easier. I know
bigger problems, right?
We live in a suburb and it's kind of rural. It's very woodsy and very quiet. And my backyard studio. You know, it's one of those things, like, we bought the house with a little bit of land thinking, yeah, one of these days I'm going to build this giant studio that's as big as the house, if not bigger, like two stories.
It'll have a pool.
Yeah, exactly. But then, like, you save money and you try and then, but you're not going to wait forever. And there was a time like 7, 8 years ago, and I'm like, okay, I'm going to have to do it. And this is what I could afford. And it's a shed.
Yes.
You know, instead of like this giant thing. But so we call it the shed. I mean, it's a little bit nicer than like a tool shed, but right. I do spend a lot of time there, and I spend a lot of late nights there. So, you know, when kids come home and, like, you know, no, the house is empty, like, they know mom's in the shed.
Yes. We don't know what she does out there, but yeah. She's out there. Did you set it up? I love, like, my ideal situation for every artist parent is a detached, like, garage or shed studio. So I'm just curious, for us, we renovated our one car garage, which already had electric run to it from the house, I think, or maybe we had to run extra electric out there. But we put in a split system to keep it cool, like to keep the temperature controlled. Is that a similar to what you did?
No. I mean, I have electricity there, and I have like a plug-in, kind of like this floor unit that has AC and heater unit, which really doesn't work very well.
Okay.
So I'm constantly cold in the winter and super hot and a little slightly mildewy in
but
the
it's,
summer.
It works in terms of your materials. Like, there's not, yeah.
No, I mean, I kind of, yes.
Yeah.
I mean, I have seen some older paintings that I think are cracking, maybe like the wooden ones, because of the humidity factor, because it's very, very humid here in the summer.
Okay.
I do run the humidifier like all summer long, but I think, you know, sometimes it goes down to below zero and it stays that way. Luckily, it hasn't in the last couple of years, but, you know, I think it's tough, you know, having a outdoor place that is not like fully like a house, because no matter how well you insulate it, I'm keeping it between like 45, you know, and 60 at the most in the winter times. Yeah,
similar. I think that's the toughest thing about those kind of studios is, you know, managing the temperature. Okay, and then, Leah, why don't you describe your work, like, for somebody who's new to you, you know, being introduced to you through the podcast, talk about what you make.
Yeah. So I'm a oil painter, and I paint draped cloth that are very, very ornate in nature, usually like because of the decoration or the type of fabric or color. A lot of brocades and lace because of the texture, and they're painted very realistically, kind of bordering on the Trump Lloyd tradition.
Awesome.
Is that summing up?
Yeah, that's, you know, your elevator pitch. You got it down.
Thank you.
I love that. This episode is sponsored by the Thrive Together Network. TTN is a virtual community I run for women artists. We have a space right on the network for artist caregivers to connect, and it is truly my favorite place on the internet. Every Tuesday, I co-host a session called Art and Tea, where our community comes together to connect as artists. We share our goals and provide accountability for each other and talk about lots of topics artists deal with, ranging from how to put on an exhibition, organization tips for your studio, ways to manage stress, and so much more. The Thrive Together Network is an inclusive platform for artists, and so much is included in your membership. It's crazy. We offer 2 virtual art residencies a year to help you stay on track with your studio goals. We have an exhibition program called Taking Up Space, those Tuesday art and tea sessions that I mentioned. We have monthly workshops on art business, art writing. We even have a book club. Plus, there's hundreds of artists to connect with from all over the world. Because of the Artist Mother partnership with TTN, we have a discount code for you just for artist caregivers to join the network. You can take $10 off your monthly membership fee for the Thrive Together Network, but your best deal is actually if you sign up for a year with us, commit to a whole year of joining us and joining our programming, and you'll save over $140 on your membership. So head to www.artistmotherpodcast.com/network to learn more and check it out. Membership comes with a free 2-week trial too, so you can truly get in there and see what you think before you actually commit to becoming a member. Just a reminder, on the network, we have a special group for artist caregivers where we have intentional conversations about our roles and identity as artists who are making work and balancing all of the caregiving that we do. We even have quarterly meetups for this group for deeper times of connections. I would really love to get to know you on the network, see more about your work and your art practice, and just connect with you in this amazing, compassionate, intentional, and encouraging community of female artists. We are all about providing resources to help you grow your art career, and this effort is combined with tools and the means to connect with the artists who are on a similar path, who are doing similar things with their careers. So once again, you can head to artistmotherpodcast.com/network to learn more, to get our discount code, and to join the Thrive Together Network. So I loved the way that you kind of described your experience using art to both process American culture, like as a new, you know, Korean immigrant to the U.S. when you were 10-ish. And, you know, now I see this trajectory in your work, and now there's a lot more integration of your Korean heritage, of course, in your work and kind of painting about that. So I was just interested in that sort of flow of how, you know, it, like, art kind of provided you this way to process this one huge part of your new identity as an American kid. And then as you've moved toward adulthood, you've, you know, kind of brought back in your Korean heritage, which is just so lovely to have those two things kind of in conversation. I wondered if you wanted to talk a little bit about the ebb and flow of that trajectory and how you decided to really engage your Korean heritage and your Korean identity in your painting practice.
Sure. Yeah, and it comes and goes, the narrative of mm-hmm. my background. And I think when I was in school as a student, you learn about, like, you gotta be, you know, conceptually rigorous. Like, you want to get all your skills, but, like, you gotta have a theme, and it's mm-hmm. gotta be, you know, cohesive. And then once you have it, then you gotta, like, work on it for a long time and have this, like, whole body of work. And so there was a bit of a pressure of trying to incorporate my background. And I mm-hmm. also felt at the time, as I was approaching, thinking about grad school, like, it's not as prevalent. I feel like now it's like you have to have, like, everybody's wearing culture under sleeve yeah. with their work. And it's wonderful, but there was a little bit of that happening, and always being, like, the minority kid, like, you know, at Indiana University, I was, like, you know, one of the few right. non-white students. I really felt like it was an asset, like, and, you know, the professors really encouraged me to, like, go for it, you know, like, try that, because mm-hmm. that's what you got. Like, I wasn't, like, the best figure painter. I wasn't, like, mm-hmm. the best landscape painter. I didn't quite fit anywhere. But I had a story to tell that, like, no one else had, you know, mm-hmm. and I think that helped me. And I'm sure that's what helped me get into a, you know, decent grad school program. And so I pursued that for a while, and it comes and goes. It really depends on, like, what's going on in my life. I think the work shifted a bit when I had children. So then, like, I'm then the work was still about Korean, being Korean or Korean culture, but it was kind of filtered through the eyes of my children. Mm. My work changed dramatically when they were like sort of toddler, you know, school, primary school age, when I was reading a lot to them and I was trying to engage them in, you know, like one, get them to read or want to read.
Yeah.
And two, like, go like, wait, and they're biracial, their father is Caucasian. So, you know, you're trying to, introduce them to Korean culture, always keep that, you know, available. And then my son was really into Greek mythology at some point, like, you know, second grade or something. And he's got all these like monsters and like Trojan horse, I don't know, like these kind of cool things. Mm-hmm. And then I start digging up all these. I'm like, wait, like Koreans have cool things too.
Yeah.
Dragons. They just, they look more like a snake, but we got, you know.
Right.
So I started buying all these folktale books.
Mm.
And luckily by this time, this is like, you know, early 2000s, I was able to find books in English and in Korean. And sometimes like in both, in like, you know, there's so many things available in that are bicultural. Mm-hmm. So I was able to find all these great books on Korean folklore, and I was reading them to them and showing them all these pictures of cool, you know, monsters we have,
mm-hmm.
like creatures we have. And that, you know, definitely just spilled over into my studio, which was really wonderful.
In what ways did it, like, were you incorporating that imagery into the work at that time?
Absolutely. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. So I've been working with, just prior to that series of Dokkaebi, which just means goblins, like it's a Korean goblin series.
Okay.
I was working these figurative narrative paintings, and they were sort of window framed kind of artwork that had really ornate curtains to it. So
yes.
The drapery and the curtain or the fabric was always there. It's been there for a long time. But then I wanted to use the curtains in a different way. And so I basically just took all the fabrics that I've gathered over the years of painting the window paintings, like creating curtains out of them. Mm-hmm. So I had a closet full of really busy fabric, like just flower patterns, you know, just stripe patterns, and start laying them out in a way that I could create these, some of these folklore to happen. So it was a big jump in my mind. But luckily, the gallery at the time was very supportive. You know, they thought it was similar enough as far as like the color. You know, certain things stay the same. Like I like mm-hmm. very contrasted tonal paintings with really bright, intense colors. So some of those formal elements remained the same, but
mm-hmm.
the mode of the narrative, how I delivered it, was very different. And so it would have. A lot of times I'll have these like little goblins running around or my children running around in the painting. So it would change. It changed a lot because of that. And that lasted many years.
I'm just looking back through the Windows series on your website. I love the like kind of, you know, the early 2000s work where you're really kind of thinking of, like, you can tell you're processing your role as a mother, right? Like
yes.
you're trapped in your home and looking out at the world, or is this everything that she wanted? That one piece, like, it's so beautiful with the sink full of dishes. We'll have to make sure we include those on the post when we share your work. But tell me too about how, you know, fabric and textile has always been, it seems like, a part of what you've chosen to focus on in your work. And, you know, as somebody who makes mixed media work, I'm just wondering if you ever actually incorporated textile, or if you've always kind of stayed within the oil painting and just, you know, painting textiles. But I would love to hear about just, you know, conceptually, like specifically using fabric as a means to sort of process, you know, everything that you're processing within your work.
Yeah. Starting with the windows, like earlier windows didn't have any curtains to them. They were mm-hmm. actually just like a wooden frame or like Venetian blinds, like typically what you would have like at a rental apartment, which
right.
is we were living at the time, before children. And then, you know, just to come up with a variety of themes for those window paintings, I start, you know, dressing them with different fabrics. And I remember curtains are kind of funny in that, like, I hate curtains. And I think curtains are kind of out of, you know, sort of like the contemporary trend right now. Mm-hmm. It's one of those things that's tied back to like getting married, and my mother-in-law, who's who was wonderful, sort of traditional New England mom, who we truly believed in curtains. She would, you know, she would visit our apartment, you know, that's like, you know, it's a rent, and you know, like Paul and I'd be like, we're just here for like 2 years and we don't know where we're gonna be next. And so, you know, we just have whatever the blinds that they give you, you know, with the rental. And she'd come over and be like, I know it's a rental, but honey, here's some curtains you can hang up meanwhile. And if you don't have heavy curtain, here's some lace curtains you can put up, you know. So that to me, so like this is something very domestic and something very specific about certain types of curtains. Mm-hmm. And that this woman, and then so again, it's like kind of like growing and learning about like becoming a wife and mm-hmm. having a relationship with mother-in-law, and we all have different types. Mm-hmm. And she was kind of lovely. She knew I would never buy curtains, and I'm too busy doing, you know, my own thing. So she would just gently kind of bring it all over and go like, do you need, can I come over Sunday and just hang it? And, you know, and I would never say no. I would say, okay. So she'll hang them, and then I'll look at them and go like, you know, this is my mother-in-law you know, telling me like gently, really gently, like all windows should have window dressing. But I love that. I love that. And I love like her choice of fabric is so reflective of her. So I start thinking about how something simple as window dressing really reflects a person's personality, you know, the mm-hmm. choice of material, what type and what kind of hang. I learned a lot, like, you know, I do a swag and like what you're supposed to do. Like, I have no idea. So I love how like something simple as window dressing can really embody a person. Mm-hmm. So I start using that more in the painting. So when I choose a fabric, I'm thinking about a particular person or a type of home that might be that's reflected in the window. Mm-hmm. Some are very bright and cheerful, and some are a little bit more somber. Some are more contemporary or conservative. So I almost started to think of them as like a replacement for the characters. Mm. And so little by little, I just got really interested in the technical difficulties, and my work was getting a little bit tighter and a little bit more realistic. Mm-hmm. Because the to express the actual, you know, characteristics of the fabric became so important. So then I had to really get it right. I couldn't just do it like a little bit and kind of get away with it. So as that series progressed, like you see the curtains kind of slowly close. So there's more of the fabric and very little of the window.
Yes.
And I really enjoy that. And I think maybe it has to do with also like, you know, having young kids by that point at the end of that series, and I have young kids, and if I get 3 hours to paint or 2 hours to paint, I don't want to think. I just want to like just kind of get into it and mm-hmm. just really dig in and do kind of, I know it sounds bad, but like kind of tedious, monotonous, like boring stuff, but that you're kind of like knitting. Like I'm not a good knitter. So like I have to like really focus. I'm not one of those people. I needed to focus. So it really fit my life at the time to just hone in and deal with the small moments and just like work on like 3 square inch for that mm-hmm. next 2 hours. And I was very happy doing it if I can get away with it.
I love how this work too is very much about, or at least what I'm reading into it is kind of about the exterior and exterior lives that we have, you know, the relationship between like privacy and intimacy and the domestic home life versus what you kind of see outside going on around you. I feel like this work is so strong, like early pandemic, right? Where we're kind of, and it's, you know, you're making this work like 10 years before that all happened, but just, I remember I curated a show during like week two of lockdown. I was doing these virtual short like curations. And the second theme that we picked with Pam Taylor, and the second theme that we picked was looking out and looking in, and just this relationship of exactly what I just said, like the interior, who you are at home, but then like what's going on in the world around you and how there's some fear in that, obviously related to the pandemic, but even just, you know, like the kind of nurturing, like intimate environment you are trying to create as a young family. And then there's this big scary world out there. Like some of that is going on in these. I think they're so, so beautiful. I love too, like artists who pick sort of, you know, symbols for like characters in their life and kind of, you know, let that open up really this form of expression. Cause, you know, sometimes I think artists, we pick things and they feel limiting, but really they can provide this system where I can use this fabric in 2005 and in 2055, and it can mean like the same thing and have these threads that like carry through. Do you find yourself collecting a lot of fabric because you paint it? So is it like around in your home and you're looking at it and painting it?
They're all in my studio.
Okay.
It's just like a giant closet, like a storage closet, and it's just full of fabrics that that has provided many, many reiterations. Like it's been reborn many times through different series because I love the fabric so much, or it's so versatile, or there's plenty of fabric, so much money wasted, where like I order it thinking it's gonna be fantastic. You know, you order yards of it and then it just never worked out, you know, it just didn't materialize. But I do have a giant collection of really busy fabric because there's nothing quiet about it and nothing useful. You know, like I can't ever use it to like make a cushion because you would never want that as a cushion in your house.
Well, so you have to deal with the bane of my existence, which is how to store fabric that I'm eventually going to use in my studio, even though you're not actually using it in the same way. Storing fabric so that you can still see it all is just kind of a challenge.
Yes, it's constantly being reorganized.
Yes, yes. And I'm like, do I organize it by color or type, or like there's many options. Tell me about the Pogagi series. I'm familiar with that term. I thought that was a type of Korean quilting.
It is.
But does it also mean that bundle of like wrapping something in fabric?
Yeah, it's funny. Now Pogagi is used more as like an art form. You know, you're like, you see these beautiful quilted, you know, art pieces hanging.
Right.
But in a very, very simple terms, it's just any kind of remnant fabric like that you have that you're going to use just for wrapping stuff and storing. Or like, for instance, we used to have these like particularly sewn Pogagi fabric to put over food, you know, if you're instead of, you know, to keep bugs away. So it's just kind of like leftover fabric that's around. So that is the term. The shape of it, so the shape of that isn't quite like what Pogagi means. The shape is actually, it's a very similar word, so it gets confusing. It's potari, which means a bundle. And there are many wonderful Korean artists who are working with this kind of bundle idea too. And they might use the term potari. But yes. So, and I decided to go with Pogagi because it's a little bit more universally well known as like a terminology that is associated with the idea of using remnant fabric.
Okay.
So I love the history behind it. So I decided to kind of strategically go with that.
Well, and tell me about the concept of that work, like the idea of the bundle, like representing something, and why you've painted this gorgeous series of these.
Yeah. So while I was doing the sort of folklore paintings that used the fabric, like silky Asian mm-hmm. fabric, as sort of backdrops for landscapes, in the middle of that, I had ordered my daughter her first hanbok, which is a Korean traditional dress, and mm-hmm. I ordered it from Flushing, like from Queens, New York, mm-hmm. and it came and it was an inexpensive dress, but she needed one for this occasion. And it came wrapped up in a bojagi, like the silk. Yeah, kind of like that. It comes in a bundle. And Koreans do this, they still do this, where like if it's an important ceremonial gift, they'll mm-hmm. wrap it in a beautiful silken bojagi that's mm-hmm. specifically made for that, and do mm-hmm. like a fancy bow tie at the top. Mm-hmm. So the dress comes in a UPS box and I open it, and then there's this like beautiful bundle, and I'm like, mm-hmm. oh my God. And the way it was tied, it was so carefully done. And then I carefully untie it to look at the dress, and the dress was like, okay. And it was kind of inexpensive. I know what I ordered.
Right.
But you know, like the experience of like getting this bundle that you have no, like, you mm-hmm. know what it is, but like it's that, like anticipation of like unwrapping the gift, you know, and that the action of like actually untying the fabric, which was beautifully done, and you're just careful with that. So I love that idea, and so I literally just retied it that dress. I'm like, okay, I saw the dress, I'm gonna tie it back up, and I painted it, and it was very different than the things that I were doing that were going on in the studio. But again, like taking a little leap, and I really enjoyed doing it, and, mm-hmm. and I enjoyed the simplicity of it. And in some ways, like if you look at all my work up until that point, they're kind of complex. You know, there's got a lot going on. There's like stories going on. There's like birds flying. Mm-hmm. There's window reflections. Whenever I get lost, I just complicate my work. That's my solution for a lot of things. I'll just add more elements.
Right.
This was the first time where like I felt very, you know, kind of insecure about it, thinking like, oh, it's just like one thing like on a black table, and I don't know if it's enough to carry mm. as a painting and successful image making. But luckily, it was really well received. Mm-hmm. I remember my gallerist going like, oh, okay, this is different. Like, oh, yeah, but let's try it, you know, like, let's try hanging a few. But it did very well. And I think like something about the simplicity and something about that, the gift, you know, the idea of a gift and the mm-hmm. like sort of idea of the concealed as well, which is a very important part of my work, even through the window series. Yeah. And not knowing what's in it, and then throw some pretty colors on it.
Yes. Yeah. No, I as you're talking through that, I was definitely making connections to the interior exterior relationship that the window has, that yes. that the bundle also has, because it's like you're processing the outside but also wondering what's inside, and kind of that relationship.
Yes, yes.
I feel like you brought up a really important point that not every artist does this, but I certainly, this is something that I've struggled with in my studio practice, is the idea of overworking something or overcomplicating it when you're feeling like insecure, and how actually you can literally see like your work over time has become conceptually simpler in a lot of
yes.
ways.
Yes.
And I think that's a really just like an important point, you know, to make, that sometimes confidence comes through our ability to edit and to simplify our ideas down to be like one really powerful thing, you know?
Yeah. I love the way you just put that, because I'm like, I'm gonna have to use that.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, that's what I see through your work and like what you've just shared. Anything else you want to say about that like trajectory?
Yeah.
And maybe just strengthening your muscle of like editing and yeah.
I think it kind of goes back to like, it just came out that way. Like earlier on when I was talking about my undergraduate experience, like I just didn't, it was a kind of a school where like it was skill-based, but not really. Like you're kind of like thrown in, like you kind of have to know what you're doing. And I kind of always like have to, I'm always trying to figure out like, okay, I can't do that, so I'm going to do this. I'm always kind of compensating in my own mind. And hopefully that compensation or that niche you find is good for you and it works out and it's a good match. When I, my current work right now, I mean, it's fairly new. It's only been going on for a couple of years, like maybe like a year or two before the pandemic. And I think, you know, it was a big shift in that, like, I just kind of ran out of stories, you know, I don't know. It's like, I ran out of stories and, you know, I painted about everything. Like I painted about like the Korean War. I mean, I painted about like my parents' store, my parents' restaurant, raising children, you know, raising biracial children. Like I feel like I've had all these stories and I expressed them out or like pushed it all out. And it's also at the same time, like the narratives that I'm seeing at the galleries and museum, you know, in the art world is so, I just feel so distanced from it. You know, I don't know if that's, I just feel like, I'm not part of that conversation. I mean, maybe I could have been, you know, 20 years before when I was speaking that language, but I'm just pooped out, like telling stories. And, and I think that's like, okay.
Right? I mean, you brought up this point before that there is this large identity narrative push, like in kind of, you know, current art world culture. And, you know, I know there's so many artists that don't want to just be known for being the artist who paints about Korean identity, you know? Right. And I mean, I feel that as an artist parent, even, and somebody who runs a platform for artist mothers, it's like, I'm not just making work about motherhood just because I'm a mom, you know? Right. And which is not to say that maternal art is not so important, but, you know, I want there to be more complexity to like what I'm able to bring, not just make it rooted in my identity. But then, you know, your identity as an artist, of course, is what shapes like your narrative. So it is like this like kind of fine line. But I do feel like I understand what you mean about just wanting sort of the work to have presence even in its quietness, you know, and just, and feeling like there's just so much busyness out there in the art world right now. And how, I don't know, like maybe that sense of belonging is like, you're just in a different season of output, you know, and meditation and
that's really well put. Just different season, you know, and I think, you know, who knows, maybe I'll tell stories of being like a menopausal woman or something, you know, that might be a new narrative coming up. But for now, I kind of felt like, okay, there's all this conversation going on and I feel so out of it. And all I want to do really is just be in my studio and do really tedious work. Now, can I sustain a career with that? I don't know, you know, but it, I think around that, and I wasn't sure. And even when I first start making some of these kind of non-narrative, like Trump Loy paintings, I wasn't sure, you know, and you're never sure about anything. And then COVID happened and then my gallery closed for good. And it kind of gave me a new slate, you know, like a clean slate. I'm like, all right, well, that gallery that I was showing all that my Korean work is no longer here anymore. I can do whatever I I want. I felt very, very free. Like it didn't matter, you know, and I'm sure with all that uncertainty with COVID, there was a great freedom too. Remember, like we could just stay home and do whatever and nobody gave me any pressure.
Yep.
So I just I didn't necessarily drop what I was doing with Bojagi things. I was doing smaller Bojagi things just to kind of sustain like daily sort of ritual of painting. But I really wanted to just focus on like, what do I really like about doing this? It's like, it's just sitting there looking at fabric and like literally counting stitches on that embroidery of a flower and trying to emulate it with paint. And I don't know if that's like a worthy cause, but like that gave me great joy for the next 3 hours, right? So I wanted to do that. And I just kept doing that. And this is the new body of work that grew out of that kind of like kind of shutting out the world and the expectations of, you know, being that Korean artist or having that Korean narrative and going like, nope, just going to be like the best painter I can be.
Yeah.
And specifically best fabric. Like, let's get really, really, really nitty gritty to what I want to do and go like, just be really good at one thing, you know, and that's something to be, you know, that's a great motivation. Just try to get really. And then every day I go into the studio, I'm like, I don't know if I didn't hit it last time with that fabric, I'm going to do it again and try to make it better. Try to make it as good as I can make it and be proud of that. You know?
Oh, so inspirational. I feel like what you just described was this journey of actually finding a lot of freedom in, you know, distilling your work down and allowing it to fit your needs rather than, you know, kind of feeling like we have to make art to fulfill a certain need that we have, like to be understood or to whatever it is, you know. I think that's so powerful and beautiful. So thank you for making the work that you're making. Leah, I have a couple more questions and we'll wrap up. I'm wondering a little bit about just the practical nature of, you know, the artist mother juggle of like, you know, you mentioned you teach at two different universities. I don't know if you're currently working for a gallery or if that gallery is the one that you mentioned that's closed, but you know, you're maintaining this rich painting practice while also launching a kid out of your home as a freshman in college. And then you still have a teenager at home. I know you're in a partnership. So do you have any like what are some things that you do to kind of keep all that afloat? What helps you get through that juggle, I guess?
Yeah, do I get through it? I don't know. I feel like I'm just stumbling.
You had time to talk to me, so.
Fridays, I don't teach, thank goodness. I have like, you know, there's some dedicated days. It's a lot, you know, it's definitely having a partner who's supportive. And we've been married 25 years. Mm-hmm. And we still fight over little things like that laundry isn't going to get folded by itself. You know, we still, after 2.5 decades, we're still talking like that. But meanwhile, somebody has to pick up the kid, you know, otherwise it's going to be stranded at school or at some practice. It's constant juggle. And I think, and then we both have aging parents. So we're like the quintessential sandwich generation, you know. I try to go for a walk. I mean, that's one thing that kind of stabilized me that I try to do for my own good, and just like listen to some like podcasts like yours and Art Grind and like or mystery, like murder mysteries, whatever for an hour. I try 45 minutes an hour. But during that time, my mom is texting about the bathroom habits of my father.
Yes.
Is this okay? And I'm like, please. It's a constant juggle. I think you just roll with it. You know, we do a lot of planned meals. Like we do a lot of things. We have to plan ahead. Like who's going to make what on Thursday night? Because there's like really late, you know, theater practice for somebody, you know, or something like that. And I can't always, you know, do everything I want to do. Like there's there was an opening last night in New York City, and I'm very fortunate. I live like 2 hours away, so I could go on a train, mm-hmm. but it wasn't going to happen because, you know, my husband couldn't pick up my daughter from the late practice and I need to be here, you know, that kind of thing. So you miss out, you know, I didn't get to see those friends. So you constantly compromise, but mm-hmm. as you know, like, then they're off to college and then you just miss them and you're like, what happened? Like, yes. 18 years just flew by and I was complaining about like, who's going to do the laundry? Like, you know, so.
Yeah. I have my oldest is starting middle school in the fall and I'm already like, this is the pivot where, you know, I can feel that just get it over with as soon as possible intensity of the young kids slipping away. And it's like, I've flipped the switch and I'm like, oh my God, it's going so fast. Like, where's the in between where we're like, you know, just, I don't know. What do we feel in the in-between? We either feel intense overwhelm or we feel intense joy, you know, like.
Yeah. I don't think you ever get that break. And then it only happens like in moments where you go like, okay, life is good. Like all the kids are healthy and, you know, and dinner was done. Like there was dinner, somebody ate something.
Right.
But they only come in little tiny glimpses. Yeah.
Yes. Okay. Well, tell me what is in your art studio life. What are some goals that you have kind of coming up that you're working on? Anything that you're working towards or that you either like that's already on the calendar or that you're just kind of like metaphorically, I really want this big thing to happen.
Yeah. I just started working with a new gallery. Anthony Brunelli, and they have some of my recent work and we're working towards a show, a small show. So that just gives me, you know, it's always good to have like a deadline and a goal to work for towards that. And I think it's really great. I'm 51 now, staring down at 52, and I think because of that shift in the work as well. And mm-hmm. I think it's also thanks to COVID, you know, one of those things. Mm-hmm. I just feel like I can kind of do, I want to do what I want to do, you know, and just
live the life you want to live.
Yeah. Be happy in the studio and not care so much about, you know, the outside voices that's always, you know, chattering in my head.
Yeah.
Just kind of focus, you know, and just continue to make the work that I'm making. And I like to make more work. And I like to say, I want to say no to more things when you get invitations. I remember like one of your podcasts, Cassie Arnold, there was a segment about like saying no. Like, and I love that when I hear younger women saying that, like, mm-hmm. like I didn't know how to say no. And I'd say yes to everything, you know, and mm-hmm. run around at crazy jobs and every gig, every show. Cause you felt like if you say no, then mm-hmm. they'll never ask you again.
Yep.
But, I feel really at peace where I can kind of focus on and making stuff that I want to make and say no, you know, mm-hmm. When it's not like a great thing, if I don't really want it, you know.
Yeah.
My daughter recently said, like, I'm gonna stop buying like all this clothes. I'm just gonna just buy something that I really, really love. And if mm-hmm. I don't love it, I'm not gonna buy it. I'm like, wow, that's really wise of that.
Yeah.
I wanna do that in my studio where like I'm gonna make it because I really, really love it. And I'm gonna do that show because it's really worth it. And I'll go teach there, but not here because I don't love it, you know?
I feel like that kind of call towards just intense intentionality and smarter decision-making. And also like the word stability kind of keeps coming in my head, like kind of, you know, and not like I'm trying so hard to keep everything together, but just maybe like an integration of ease and flow and just like celebrating. I think that's something I'm really craving in my life too. Like after these intense periods of having young kids and childbirth and building this community and all this stuff I'm doing, it's like, all right, we do this big building and then it's like, you just got to deconstruct it all, you know? And I'm sure like over the course of a life, we go through like those peaks and valleys, but I really appreciate you speaking to, yeah, just like a simpler, more conscientious, like way of trying to construct your life as an artist and parent. So, and I know you're not, you know, like it's all difficult. Like we all have our challenges. But I just think that's really valuable, work and words of wisdom. So thank you, Leah. Okay. Let's close with our final five questions.
Okay.
Who is your biggest art crush? Of the moment or over your life? You know, I know there's so many.
Yeah. I just discovered this artist name. It's Mehdi Gadiyanlu.
Okay.
It's very hard to say.
Yeah.
He actually shows like a Gaussian, but I haven't seen his work in real person in real life, but his work, I realize, is kind of like what I'm doing, but like 2000 times better. Thus representative like a Gaussian.
Yes.
But it's one of those things that you like, it just blew my mind. It came up in an Instagram feed and I'm like, what?
Yes.
It's like me, but like just way more brilliant. So I'm really into his work, and I went in a little rabbit hole of like researching about his background and how he came to work on the work that he's doing right now. So
awesome. I love that. I love finding, like, it's like a love-hate relationship. Like,
yeah.
Like, I love what you're doing, but also how
can you be so much smarter and so much better and so successful?
Okay, what is your favorite place to travel to, or maybe a dream trip that you'd like to go on?
It's not too recent, but we went to Crete as a family.
Mm.
And it was really great. Like it's so remote. It's so hard to get. It's like so far away, you know, even from Athens. But once you get there, it's everything, you know. Greece is wonderful. Like people are wonderful. But Crete being so further, like just
geographically,
physically away, it's like another level of like chill factor. Mm. Like everybody's even mellower there. Everything's a little slower. So we always joke, like Paul and I always joke, like, oh, one of these days we should retire to Crete, you know. I mean, it's just a daydream. But then we'll be like, but then no one will come see us because it's so far away. We'll never see the kids.
Yeah.
So we still talk about like visiting there again. You know, we'd love to do that. My dream place to go is, you know, my bucket list is to visit the Hermitage collection in Russia, which isn't going to happen anytime soon now.
Yeah.
But it's one of those things that before the war started, we kept thinking like, let's do it this year. You know, it's a huge trip. So we kept putting it off. And now, you know, now we don't know when that's going to happen.
Well, hopefully you get to that. And Crete is such a great answer. I don't think anybody's said that before. So I'm like in my mind already. All right. Gotta Google some Crete inspiration. Such a good one. Okay. Tell me a film or a book that has been a big inspiration to you.
I have so many, but I'll be a little nerdy and recommend Anne Hollander's Fabric of Vision. I found this a few years ago, and it's a very hefty catalog of a show that she put together in the British Museum or the Tate like 10 years ago. And I never knew about it, but it's basically like how important fabric and drapery and fashion plays in art throughout history.
Yeah, and that sounds amazing.
Yeah, and it's great for anyone who's working with fabric or textiles, yeah.
You said Fabric of Vision?
Fabric of Vision, yeah.
Mm. Okay, favorite meal?
I love instant ramen. It's just, it's a cultural thing, but it's also, it's so embedded in me. But being the age I am, I'm really trying not to eat a lot of carbs, like
Yeah.
So my favorite meal will be like a really good ramen. And I don't mean like the $15 Japanese pork. I don't mean that. I mean like the cheap instant.
Yes.
Out of the package with my own fixings the way I like it. So that is still my go-to food if I when I allow myself to have carbs.
Yes, I feel you. Okay. And who would you like to give a shout out to or thank for supporting your work?
I would have to say the wonderful artist, Roger Shimomura. He is a Japanese-American painter. He's based in Lawrence, Kansas. Mm. And I met him when I was teaching out at Kansas City Art Institute. And he wasn't a, you know, he was a colleague more.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But he's much older, and he kind of had this career that, like, I really, like, looked up to and aspired yeah. to, you know, emulate. And he was always supportive, you know, always kind of helping any younger artist. And he was very, very supportive. So even when I'm doing things now, I always think, like, what would Roger do?
Oh, that's so great. There's nothing like a good mentor, especially one that you've stayed in touch with over time.
Yes.
And you've kind of seen. Okay, Leah, last, where can folks find you, your Instagram, or where do you want people to kind of follow your work?
Yeah, I'm on Instagram a lot, probably too much. but I do post quite often there, like all my progress. Work and Anthony Brunelli Gallery in New York has a bunch of my recent work, and also Garvey Simon in New York has a few of my work in their gallery as well. So I'm around.
And your Instagram and your website, your name is spelled with two E's, so LeeahJoo.
That's correct. Yes.
Okay, Leah, thank you so much. This has been such a blast, and I feel inspired. So I know everyone who listens is going to really enjoy this episode. I appreciate you.
Thank you so much. It's been wonderful chatting with you.
The Artist Mother podcast is curated and produced by Kaylin Butine. Music by Josh Middleton. Editing and mixing by John M. Butine. Please visit www.artistmotherpodcast.com for episode notes and to find out how you can further support this podcast.